Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fat is necessary. In the right amount, in you, on you, it's good. But a lot of Americans have too much and don't really understand what fat's about. It's subtle, it's stubborn, it's worth getting to know. This hour on Point, the secret life of fat. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you hitting the gym or the diet book after the holidays? Have you given up? And how do you understand fat? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Do we obsess over it? Sometimes we do. Fat, weight, all the rest. Season 17 of The Biggest Loser aired last year. Here's a moment from the finale when trainer and host Bob Harper announced that contestant Roberto Hernandez had won the competition. He started at 348 pounds.
Roberto, in order for you to beat Steven and win the grand prize and title of The Biggest Loser, you need to have lost 150 pounds or more. Your current weight is... Your current weight is 188 pounds. You lost 160 pounds. You're the biggest loser, Roberto! Yes!
Oh, boy. He lost 160 pounds, and of course, there's a lot of fat in there. Joining me now from Irvine, California, is Sylvia Terra, author of the new book, The Secret Life of Fat. Sylvia, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Here you are, a biochemist. You went out and read report after study after study after study, maybe 1,000 of them, on fat. What got you so focused on that stuff?
Oh, well, I struggled with fat all my life, really, and I got very tired of just watching people be able to eat more than me, exercise less, and yet somehow stay thinner. I got on a number of diets. I'd lose some. I'd gain it back. Sometimes I wouldn't lose as much as other people. And I finally got very fed up with watching this, and I decided I am going to learn everything there is to know about fat, particularly my very stubborn fat. And I am a biochemist by training, so I had the tools to really dig in, and I spent years, about 5 years, reading every scientific paper I could get my hands on. I spoke to dozens of leading researchers around the world about their cutting-edge research on fat, and what I was finding out was so astounding, really so surprising, I thought I have to capture this in the book. And The Secret Life of Fat is that book.
Well, take us into it. I mean, for a lot of us, I think we think of fat as just stuff, unwelcome stuff around our belly or our hips or wherever it may be, just kind of hanging there stuff. It's a lot more subtle than that, reading in your book. Begin to introduce us at a more nuanced level to what's going on with fat.
Yeah, so fat is not just fat, and that was the most surprising thing to me. We think of it as a reserve of calories, something that has to be gotten rid of. It's excess. But really, fat in its totality is an endocrine organ, meaning it produces hormones that our bodies depend on. For example, our brain size is actually linked to fat, brain volume. Our immune system is strengthened by fat. Our bones are dependent on fat. It has so many functions in our body as an endocrine organ that it's actually quite important. And because it is important, your body works overtime to protect it, really. For example, fat can release a hormone called leptin, and leptin has direct control on appetite and metabolism. So when we lose fat, we lose some leptin, and our appetite goes through the roof, our metabolism goes down, it gets very hard to lose weight after that. And what's surprising is that it doesn't really matter how you lost the fat. If you did it by eating less, even liposuction will have that effect on people, and that's important to know. So afterwards, you have to eat a little bit less after you lose some weight, about 22% fewer calories. And that's something people don't really understand.
Wait, after you lose weight, you have to maintain a steady state, you have to eat less than you did when you were heavier?
Yeah, and just to be more clear about that, so say if someone's 150 pounds naturally,
okay.
and then someone is 170 pounds, but they lose 20 pounds to get to 150 pounds, mm-hmm. they actually have to eat about 22% fewer calories than someone who's at 150 pounds naturally. So there's this kind of caloric penalty, if you will, after you lose weight. You have to eat a little bit less than people around you at the same weight naturally. And I think
Forever.
It has been studied for 6 years, and they find that it has lasted for up to 6 years, and they're not sure if it ever goes away. So this might be a permanent effect of yo-yo dieting, if you will, and it's one of the reasons some people really do have to eat less than others at the same weight.
Fat is an organ, part of the endocrine system, and you reeled off a couple of effects there that I want to just dig into to understand. Fat has something to do with brain size. Do you mean in infancy and childhood as our bodies develop or later?
No, overall, that's part of our development, certainly. So, you know, studies of mice show that when they are leptin deficient, they have a genetic defect and they don't produce leptin. Their fat is defective. They actually have smaller brain size. And yet injecting leptin back into them actually builds their brain size up. And they find this in humans, too. So humans who have a defect in their fat, they have a defective gene, they actually are missing tissue. They have smaller volume in certain parts of their brain. And putting leptin back into them actually helps grow that back. And people with anorexia nervosa will lose volume in their brain as well. And it does come back if they are able to recover. But it does have an effect on brain size, even some brain functioning. They find that the children who are missing this important hormone leptin from fat, they act a little bit differently. They're more docile. They actually don't go through puberty correctly.
And they would be missing the leptin because they just had too low-fat a diet? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, there's two ways. I mean, one is you actually don't have enough fat. That's one way to be leptin deficient. Mm-hmm. You know, dieting in a way makes us somewhat leptin deficient because we're losing fat and losing leptin. But then there's a genetic defect as well, people who have a defect in the OB gene. And they have fat. They have plenty of fat, but it's not producing leptin. It's just a genetic defect that their fat doesn't produce that hormone.
What about the immune system? You mentioned the immune system and the role of fat in relation to it. What?
Yeah, so our T cells actually have receptors for leptin. So leptin affects a whole bunch of things in our bodies because it's a very, you know, vast and impactful hormone that our body depends on. So our T cells have receptors for it, and they bind with leptin, and that actually helps them become more active, and it helps them propagate as well. And people with, again, genetic defects and don't have proper leptin levels, they do have lower T cell count, and they are more prone to infection.
But again, that's genetic. That's not about related to my behavior in terms of eating or the weight I sustain.
No, so when for normal people, let's get into that for a bit. So when you're normal, when you lose fat, when you're dieting, and when you lose fat, you lose some leptin. And so when you do lose leptin, you do get a higher appetite, and your metabolism gets down, and you get overall just a little bit more obsessive about food. Some of these very big problems you probably won't have unless you are, you know, truly have a genetic defect or you really are in that anorexia nervosa state with very little leptin. But you can get too low of fat for some things, like reproduction. So fat also produces estrogen. And our bodies, especially women, the reproductive systems, are dependent on fat for estrogen and for leptin as well. And when women get too low of a weight, they either delay puberty if they've not gone through it already. They can delay it by a couple of years, or they can start losing their menstrual cycles and they can't conceive. And you do find this with people with eating disorders, certainly. If they get too thin, they have problems reproducing. It's not till you get to extremely low levels of fat that you could have some impact to your immune system, impact to brain size, and that's what's seen with anorexia nervosa. Just very low levels of fat can cause that problem.
What about other interactions with fat, the microbes in our gut, or for that matter, our genetic profile that may influence how we hold fat, how fat behaves, and the weight we maintain?
That's right. So not only is fat itself very intricate and very interesting, but the ways we get fat is also very interesting. It's always attributed to gluttony. People are just overeating and they're slobs. It's a characterization, if you will. But there's other ways that help us get fat. So we're actually 10 times more microbial than we are human. We have 10 times more bacterial cells in our body than human cells. Naturally, that has an effect on us, and so it helps us metabolize.
You're talking about microbes in our gut, for example, is what you mean, I guess.
Yeah. All over the place, Yes, skin everywhere. But the vast majority are in our lower gut area, mm-hmm. and they help with metabolism and digesting food. So depending on what types of bacteria you have in your lower gut, you might be extracting more calories out of your food or less. And bacteria can do that because they have enzymes that we don't carry. They can actually digest some tough polysaccharides, carbohydrates that we actually can't, and turn them into simple sugars that are easy to digest. And so the example that's often given is if you imagine a bowl of cereals, the label might say, say, 100 calories per serving. But depending on your microbiome, you're either getting 120 or 80 or perhaps 100, but it is somewhat variable. And they, you know, there's some very interesting experiments, of course, in mice where they take, they grow up some mice and they make them germ-free. So they're an incubator and they're isolated and they don't have the normal microbiome. They have less. Mm-hmm. And then those raised conventionally. And when they give them the same amount of food, they find that those raised conventionally actually eat a little bit less, but they have 50% more fat than the ones in the that are raised without any bacteria at all. They're actually much thinner. And when they put the microbiome from the conventionally raised mice into the ones who are germ-free, they start gaining weight. They get 50% fatter. So it has a big impact on us.
And what about the genetic profile, let's say, of your friend who you write about, who was able to eat more or less whatever she wanted and be quite slim, whereas you didn't find that at all in your case? Is that genetic or something else?
Well, I think it's a whole bunch of factors, and that was really the reason that prompted me to do all this research. I really had to understand that. So there's all kinds of possibilities. One is the microbiome. There's even viruses linked with fatness. Genetics certainly has a big part of that. Gender plays a part. Men definitely are thinner than women for lots of reasons. And so hormones, actually, too. As we age, our hormones change. We lose some of our fat-burning hormones, and that has an effect. So someone who, say, you know, a 50-year-old woman has to eat very differently and diet very differently than a 25-year-old male. There's a number of different factors that affect our fatness, which is what I write about in The Secret Life of Fat.
Are some people just genetically inclined to be overweight?
There are a number of reasons. Yeah, and there's some genes that are actually identified. And none of that means you have to be obese or you have to be fat. What it does mean is that you have to work a little bit harder at it. For example, there's a gene identified called FTO, which affects appetite. And they did an experiment where they had two groups of kids, one with the FTO variant, one without it, and they let them go to a buffet. And they find that the children who have the FTO variant actually load their plates up with more energy-rich foods, more things like chips and chocolate. And necessarily, they have a little bit more fat as well. They're about 6 pounds overweight compared to the kids who don't have that variant. And the FTO variant also helps create fat cells, too. We create more fat cells when we have that variation.
If you go back a century and look at photographs, Americans do not look obese. Now a third or more are. Why? What's the change? It's the same, more or less the same people.
Yeah, I mean, so many changes there. One is just the food that we eat. We have a lot more processed food, certainly, and it has a lot more hidden carbs. We are more sedentary overall. But then there's also things like epigenetics. There's things, you know, talking about our genetics. We're now a mix of a different races. Some races gain more fat than others. So a lot of factors there that help tilt that up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about everything you may not know about fat and, by the way, how to lose it before we're finished here. My guest is Sylvia Tara. She's author of the new book, The Secret Life of Fat, much more nuanced substance, material, part of the endocrine system than many people understand or give it credit for. You can read an excerpt of her book at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join us this hour. What's your question on what fat is, how it works? How far have you gone to banish the fat? And has it worked? What's your craziest fat-fighting story? Maybe we can explain some of those dynamics. Lots of people wrestle with it. Here was Oprah talking with Barbara Walters in 2014 about the need to make peace with her weight. Fat right in there.
I want you to finish a sentence for me.
Oh, boy.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Sure.
Okay.
Before I leave this earth, I will not be satisfied until I...
Until I make peace with the whole weight thing.
What?
Yeah.
That's still on your mind?
Yeah, I gotta do it.
I was expecting something deeply profound, Ms.
No, that's
Winfrey.
It. I've got to make peace with it.
Ah, but it's not easy. Here was ABC's 10 Most Fascinating People of 1995, to go way back, and Barbara Walters again talking with Newt Gingrich, who was then newly elected Speaker of the House, and she asked Newt what he liked best and least about himself. He was the least.
What do you like least about yourself?
Oh, and I think I'm most embarrassed about my weight.
Oh.
I think that's probably, I mean, I know it's banal, but it's true. And I know it's entirely a function of my personality that I swim, I eat the right things, and then I either have a chance to drink some Guinness or to eat some ice cream, and I cave.
Newt Gingrich, he caves. So do a lot of us cave sooner or later. Gina Collada from the New York Times joins us in just a moment. Sylvia Terra is with us from Irvine, California. Her book is The Secret Life of Fat. Just a question or two for you before we bring Gina in as well. Michaela in Worcester, Massachusetts. Michaela, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
Good timing because I'm actually on my way to the gym.
Okay.
My question was about this idea of muscle memory. And I have some friends who go to the gym quite frequently, but they're not professional trainers or anything like that. But they say that there is this idea of muscle memory, that when you go back to the gym, it's easier than people just starting up. And I was wondering if that is a true concept, if that has any relation in fat reduction.
Sylvia Terra, though, our willingness to get busy, is fat, get active, is fat involved in that or something else?
Our willingness to get busy. So there is something, you know, I've heard the concept of muscle memory before. So you have to think of fat as we're either, you know, we can spiral up or we can spiral down. As you start to lose weight and you start to get into fat burning mode, your body changes its biological pathways. Certain proteins become upregulated that help burn fat, that help you live in this new environment that you're creating for yourselves. Same thing happens in the opposite direction. Once you start really gaining weight, you have different protein pathways that'll upregulate that help you gain that weight. So going to the gym, you create in this new environment for your body where you're exercising more, you're burning off, you know, fat, hopefully, just making your muscles a little stronger. And there will be different pathways that get expressed. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes because now you have a different biology, if you will. And our muscles, you know, they are innervated. There is some learning there that's stored as well. So there is something around, you know, certainly becomes easier for your body, but also even behaviorally. So there's, you know, experiments done where they pay people to go to the gym, and they pay people either one time a month or they pay people to go for 8 times a month. And when they stop paying it, you know, naturally people who've been going 8 times a month go without payment anymore. They've gotten a habit. And so creating habits is one of the key reasons and key ways really to keep in shape and keep working out and make those pathways such that fat loss is begetting fat loss.
Michaela, on your way to the gym, break a good sweat there. Jim in Stanton, Virginia. Jim, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
It's Jim, speaking of gyms. Yeah, thank you. I had a question. So basically, my wife and I are doing the annual holiday diet, and we've both been working out, which is unusual. You know, probably 3-4 times a week. We've been at it for 2 months.
Okay.
We've cut carbs. We've significantly improved our diet.
Yeah.
Funny thing happening, I'm losing weight slightly. I'm down 5 pounds. She's completely flatlined, despite the fact that we've added about an hour of body weight exercises 3-4 times a week and cut carbs. She's completely flatlined. It's kind of a joke, but we're also like, what's going on?
I mean, flatline meaning she's just not losing weight despite the change in activity and diet.
Despite the changes, yeah. She's 35 years old. I'm 32.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Sylvia?
Oh, I have a whole chapter about the difference between women and men. For this very reason, I watched my husband eat anything he wanted to and stay thin while I couldn't. So there's a lot going on. And women are more predisposed to getting fatter, and there's all kinds of reasons for that. One is women partition nutrients into fat more than men do. So say if you're eating 100 calories, women will store about 30 calories, say, for example, compared to men who might do 15. It's just the way we're biologically designed. We put on more fat. The other thing to know is that women actually, they do reach for fat more during exercise and during a period of fast, like the overnight fast, will metabolize fat more, whereas men will reach for glycogen and protein. However, once that fat is done, our fat is very efficient. It'll take all of those excess fatty acids in the blood and store it back into fat tissue very quickly, more so than men do. And in a way, that keeps us healthier. We have a good metabolic profile, but it does keep us fatter as well. The other big component that's a difference is testosterone. Testosterone is a major fat burner. In fact, in one experiment, they give men testosterone supplements, and they compare it to men who work out 3 times a week who don't have testosterone supplements.
Okay.
And they actually find that people with the testosterone supplements get more muscle and lose more weight than those exercising. So men overall just sitting there can lose more weight than women do.
Is it safe to have that testosterone supplement as an alternative to exercise, or is it just safe in its own terms?
Well, there's certainly risk with any kind of medical intervention. And so if you can do that naturally, and exercise does help release testosterone, you know, it's always better to do it naturally. There are side effects and for getting testosterone injections.
Sylvia Terra's new book is The Secret Life of Fat. Sylvia, please stand by there in California. Gina Collada joins us right now from New York, reporter at the New York Times, who splendidly covers science and medicine. She's been writing a lot about the science of weight loss, for a long time and very lately. Gina, thank you very much for being with us. Hello, Gina Collada. Are you there in New York? Oh, we just dropped that line. We'll get Gina right back on, and I'm sorry about that. Let's get Jack in Weston, Massachusetts. Jack, you're on the air with Sylvia Tara.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. And
yeah.
By the way, I love your show. It's always good. And finally, you're in my wheelhouse.
All right. What's your wheelhouse, Jack?
I am a neuroimmunologist.
Ooh, okay.
I am not a clinical. I do not treat patients. I research only.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, your author is, Sylvia is exactly right. We have actually found a mutation in a single strand of RNA in the myeloid stem cell, which produces suboptimal cortisol and aldosterone and progesterone. So that's why autoimmunity is far more common in women than men, and we believe we've found potentially what causes MS, Alzheimer's, ALS, Parkinson's, et cetera, et cetera.
Jack, does it go back to fat somehow? Help me here with your expertise.
Yes, it does, because inflammation in the brain can cause an addiction to food and fat production, which will then cause somebody to eat inappropriately and then process inappropriately. So the vagus nerve system, the vagal nerve,
yep.
which attaches all of the body's systems together at the hypothalamus, actually creates fat more readily in some people due to this mutation in the myeloid stem cell.
How common is this mutation? Could this amount for a substantial part of the obesity we see in this country, or is this the rare outlier?
All right, now you're going to think I'm wackadoodle. Everybody has it. It's just a question of the virulence of what's called a D2 prostaglandin, which is produced by a particular immune cell called a mast cell. And based on the virulence of your D2 prostaglandin, it can have either a neutral effect on histamine, heparin, serotonin, cytokines, leukotrienes, or up to a 1,000 times multiplying effect.
What comes first, obesity or the inflammation of the brain that makes a person ravenous?
The inflammation, without question. There's only four things that all autoimmunity have, and obesity is an autoimmune disease. So is addiction. Inflammation, plaque, vitamin D deficiency, and evidence of mast cell metabolites.
So, Jack, step back. That you're deep in the science there. What should we make of that? Are we somehow, as a population, you've seen our obesity rise, have we somehow become more vulnerable to this inflammation?
Yes. The best way to combat this, it has nothing to do with pharmaceuticals. It is to eat a low histamine, high anti-inflammatory diet, so that you are absorbing and neutralizing free radicals.
I have no idea what a low histamine diet is. What?
Well, there's if you Google it, you'll find thousands of them.
Like, what kind of food is in? Is avocados? I don't know what's in there.
Well, let me give you an example of one thing that's considered super healthy, spinach. It's one of the highest histamine foods on the planet, and it actually creates inflammation.
So don't eat spinach, but do eat what? Help me, Jack. I'm hungry.
eat kale. Eat raw protein, but not calf's liver. And also, you want to eat the freshest food you can possibly find. So no processed foods at all. Fewer ingredients, the better. And you want to eat. So as soon as something that's living is killed cultivated or, whatever, butchered, it starts to develop histamine. And different foods develop it at different levels. So, for instance, seafood develops it at an extremely high level. That's why sushi is frozen at sea.
Yeah.
It's that histamine that's affected by the D2 prostaglandin, which causes the inflammation, which then, based on an individual's RNA, determines whether they become obese or whether they get Alzheimer's or whether they get Parkinson's.
Jack, you're pretty amazing. I can tell you I'm going to walk right out of this studio and look up low histamine diet when we're finished here, and I'm going to pay attention. That's pretty darn interesting. We've got Gina Colata back on the line, Sylvia Tara in Irvine, California. Gina at the New York Times, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know if you heard our neuroimmunologist who called in there with a good lesson on histamines. I mean, people want to understand every angle they can on fat. Sylvia Tara is writing about it. You've been writing a lot about people wrestling with this. Are we moving toward a more subtle understanding of what's going on when we're eating and dealing with fat, Gina?
I'm not sure what you want me to respond to because I didn't hear the neuroimmunologist.
No, it's quite all right. I guess the main point is, for a long time, it was just eat less, exercise more, end of story. Is that still right. Where we stand, or is it more complicated, or not, in the end?
Well, what I reported on was that different people respond very differently to different interventions. And different some people can get a lot fatter on the same diet. Another person is not particularly fat on at all. I mean, that's why you'll see people, like, there have been studies, and they date back several decades, where they had, I think that Tara even reports on some of these in her book, they would have kids who were adopted, and they were adopted when they were babies, infants. They never knew their biological parents. And even though they were brought up in a home where it was a different environment than their parents would have had, they ended up with the same kind of body weight as their biological parents. In other words, you know, a diet that might have made a kid fat might have made another kid not particularly fat. So there are different paths to obesity, is what I've heard, mm-hmm. and different people respond differently to different interventions. And many people find it very hard to find anything to which they respond. So it's not that they don't care. It's not that they don't try. It's just that there is no one solution for everybody.
We want to talk about the couple that you followed who did the big stomach surgery and how their bodies responded to that. Sylvia Tara, I wonder what your thoughts, though, on our call to the neuroimmunologist there. Is it possible that just because we've got so many highly processed and not very fresh foods in our system that we could be triggering all this? You know, our brains raging with hunger because the food just isn't the optimum in terms of body weight.
So I was listening to that conversation on inflammation. There's all kinds of research out there. You know, collectively, yes, inflammation has a role. So when we get too much fat, particularly too much visceral fat, it does get inflamed, and that inflammation actually interferes with insulin signaling.
What's visceral fat?
So visceral fat is that fat underneath your stomach wall. The healthier fat depots are subcutaneous fat right under your skin. Mm-hmm. But if you get a high amount of dense, crowded visceral fat, it can start to get inflamed. And inflammation has, you know, a lot of things at stake. And one is that you become less sensitive to insulin. And so you don't absorb glucose and sugars out of the blood and fats out of the blood as readily. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of fat, and that's the inflammation that's correlated with diabetes and heart disease. There's also research, getting back to what he was talking about, that shows that inflammation can actually affect the hypothalamus, and that's where the eating center is that drives your appetite. And if it gets inflamed, and that can come from excess visceral fat, it can. Some studies shows that it comes from too much sugar. It can affect the appetite drive, and you become a little bit less susceptible, a little bit less sensitive to leptin, and so you do have a bigger appetite. And then one feeds the other, because if you're less sensitive to insulin, then you know it also leads to you're actually hungrier. And also, if your hypothalamus is not responding as much, you're hungry, which makes you even fatter, and it becomes this vicious cycle of gaining weight and being hungry.
Is there a way to get a clean slate, Sylvia? Like, sort of wipe all that personal history away? I don't know, fast for X number of days and start over? Or once you've got these chemical circumstances going on, they're just going to recreate or perpetuate?
No, absolutely there's a way to get back on track, and my book is all about that. So visceral fat, actually, you can reduce it certainly by eating less, but I want to give the story of sumo wrestlers because this is very interesting and mm-hmm. illustrates another big talent of fat. So we talked about fat producing leptin. It also makes and releases another hormone called adiponectin. Adiponectin is a great hormone, and it's a way fat keeps us healthy. So adiponectin will actually drive fat out of the blood and put it into fat tissue where it belongs. It also reduces visceral fat, and exercise promotes adiponectin. So sumo wrestlers, certainly a case in obesity. No doubt they're obese. They eat about thousands of calories a day, and they're very heavy. Amazingly enough, they don't have a lot of visceral fat, and that is because of their exercise. When they come off their exercise program, they get visceral fat. And so there are ways to be fat but fit. Certainly better to not have too much fat to begin with, but you can be healthy and get on a good track.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about everything you may not know about fat and, by the way, how to lose it. Sylvia Terra is with us from Irvine, California. Her new book is The Secret Life of Fat, about so many subtleties to the fat that we carry in our bodies and some important insights about how to lose it as well. Gina Colata is with us, reporter at the New York Times, who's written a lot about people's efforts on this point in the science of weight loss. You can join us. What's your craziest fat-fighting story? What do you want to know about how to get it off and keep it off? What it's doing that may be valuable for you when it's there? Ate fat. Gina Colata in New York, I wish you'd share with us the story of Keith and Jessica. These are two people who you followed, one a computer programmer, the other a college student, who had significant surgery to try and change their weight profile and not entirely satisfactory outcomes. I found it really illuminating about some of the very subtle issues we're talking about here. Would you introduce us to them, Gina, what they went through and what they found?
Sure. Yeah, both of them were pretty heavy. They were more than 100 pounds overweight, both of them were. And they had tried everything. They had tried their whole lives to lose weight. They tried one diet after another. And nothing really succeeded. It wasn't that they didn't care. They didn't want to be thinner. They desperately did. And finally, they decided that the only solution for them was to have bariatric surgery. In their case, they had something called a bypass surgery, where what they do first is they staple part of your stomach so it's sort of separated from the rest. They take a piece of your small intestine, they attach it to your stomach. What they're doing is bypassing part of your digestive system.
Okay.
So people thought for a while that this was just, all you're doing is just, it was a surgery. It was discovered by accident. It was discovered originally because people were trying to cure ulcers.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that people lost weight. And they said, well, it's because their stomach is smaller. Actually, that's not true. They found out when they invented other things like a gastric band, which they put like a band around your stomach to make it smaller. Didn't really work. And the reason it didn't really work was that people would kind of manage to eat around it all the time. They were so hungry, not being able to, because Jessica and Keith, it wasn't that they're saying, well, why don't you just eat less? One person says, like saying, why don't you just hold your breath for 30 minutes? It's actually a drive that they can't control so easily.
Even when, I mean, they were suffering because of their weight. She's 5'3", 295 pounds. He was 5'9", 377.
And she'd never had a date.
Yeah.
She said, I don't even know what it means to flirt with someone. To my knowledge, no one's ever looked at me like that.
Boy.
He had terrible sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
He would practically fall asleep driving his car because he was so sleepy. He was so heavy that just, it was hard to just even move around. His knees hurt, his back hurt.
Yep.
When he was home, he just sort of sat around all the time because it was so difficult. One day his son, who's 13, looked up at him and said, Dad, I don't want you to die. We have to do something. And that was kind of like the final impetus. But these people were suffering like crazy. I mean, there's so much prejudice against fat people. I mean, one of the things that they want to just go into a store like everybody else and buy clothes. I mean, the simplest things. Jessica told me that when she was in an airplane, and tried to put down the tray table, she couldn't put it over her stomach. I mean, things you don't even think about.
But they did this bariatric surgery. They did lose weight, but they didn't come out entirely satisfied. Why?
Well, they were satisfied in a way. Each of them lost about 100 pounds. Neither of them is thin. They want to be a lot thinner. The problem is that this surgery resets your brain signals for how fat you should be. And for them, it reset it significantly lower. I mean, their lives were changed. Life was a lot easier for them, but never made them really thin. Now, he said one thing he missed. He said he really liked food. He really enjoyed it. And one thing the surgery does, surprisingly enough, for unknown reasons, because there's so many changes that take place with it, is it actually changes your taste for food and things that you love. Like Keith used to love White Castle hamburgers, and he bought a bag after the surgery. They just weren't, they didn't even smell good anymore to him.
You quote a bariatric surgeon at the University of Michigan saying that, you know, before the surgery, his patient said a Reese's peanut butter cup gave her such a rush that it was like an orgasm of pleasure in the brain. Afterward, it's just peanut butter and chocolate. What's the big deal?
Right. Right. And they say they hear this all the time from patients, the things that they craved like crazy. I mean, Jessica said, you know, she used to see chocolate and she'd say, oh, my God, chocolate. And now she says she still likes it, but she doesn't have this feeling like, I have to eat it, I have to eat it. It's really strange. So there's that. So Keith misses his taste for food. He has so much more energy. Sleep apnea disappeared instantly. His blood pressure was normal before he even left the hospital.
Great.
And they're only there for like one day because you have these enormous changes. Diabetes often goes away instantly before you've lost any weight. So big changes for them. Jessica, she lost his weight. She looks different, much, much better. She looks younger, much prettier. She says she still feels like she's the biggest person in the room everywhere she goes. And she is still heavy, but there's like a night and day the way she looks now and what she used to look like. She wants to lose that extra weight. The doctors say it's just as hard to lose that extra weight as it was to lose weight in the beginning. Your brain doesn't want you to be there. So it's hard for her. Her life hasn't changed that much. Partly, I think, because you become sort of a social recluse. She says, my home is still my safe place. She lives with her mother. She's 24.
These are habits she developed when she was so obese.
Yeah, because when you go, you know, it's hard to go out in public. People are so judgmental. It's very, very difficult. One guy that I met, a surgeon in Michigan, I went to this conference of all the bariatric surgeons, and he said he's kind of an outlier because he will do surgery for people who are self-pay because their insurance won't pay for them if they don't meet the criteria. And I said, like who? He said, like teenagers. He said, they don't want to pay for them. They say they're too young to do this. And he showed me this picture of this boy. And by the way, the younger you are, the better the response to the surgery.
Okay.
You know, you come closer to your goal weight. And this kid was like the typical fat kid that maybe everybody would bully. After the surgery, he looked really buff. I mean, he was amazing. He said, can you imagine what this kid's life is like going from the before to the after? And you know, he won't grow up with all the burdens of being the fat kid that nobody wants to be friends
with. What are the downsides, Gina? I mean, it changes your digestion for life, right?
It does. It's not, there's a lot of downsides. You have to eat a lot of supplements if you have the kind that the surgery that Jessica and Keith had. They have something called, if you eat too much sugar too fast, your body can't handle it, and you have something called dumping syndrome where you're nauseous and you feel really ill.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things, you know, that you are more at risk for osteoporosis. There are a bunch of things you have to be careful with. And I guess this just shows how pitiful our efforts are to help people lose weight when, for people who are severely overweight, often the only thing that's going to work is something this drastic, which is really not fully understood. It was discovered by accident, and it makes so many changes in everything in your hormones, your nerve cells, your microbiome, the bacteria that live in your gut. Yeah. Everything changes overnight.
That bariatric surgery.
So changes, they don't know what the one thing is that makes a difference.
And yet people are willing to do it because it's such a burden otherwise. Sylvia Terry, you dove in And you write about this in The Secret Life of Fat, on your own weight, and you really went at it. You wanted to lose 30 pounds. You did it over a few months. How did you do it, Sylvia?
Yeah, so really, you know, motivation is a big key here. And there's research on successful dieters. And one of the things they find that helps them be really successful for the long term is that there's a serious emotional trigger that makes you want to lose weight. And a lot of times it's a diagnosis, like they now have a health problem, or it's just seeing a picture of themselves at an all-time high weight that they realize they now have to do something. And amazingly, you know, they go in the same grocery store they did before, but now instead of reaching for Cheetos or something, they're able to stay on a healthy diet, you know, eat healthy food, stay on it for the long term. And so motivation is a big factor here. You know, gastric bypass, it is a tool that works for some people, and I write about this too. It changes your appetite, it'll change your microbiome, you know, even change some gene expression. There is a lot of downside. I mean, it's certainly a major surgery with complications possibly. And so you have to take that seriously. I think if you get to a very high level of weight, it's an option, you know, something that to consider, because doing nothing also has risk.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do this, you know. So one of the key things is really prevention. And once fat's on us, it doesn't really want to leave. In fact, it has all these tools to stay on us. We talked about the difference in appetite, the difference in the number of calories that you have to have after you've gained weight and lost it. But it can actually divert blood supply to itself as well, just as a tumor does. It sends out signals, getting veins to grow in its direction,
wow.
Getting more blood supply.
It's like the alien in there.
It is. And so, you know, once it's on you, it has all these ways to stay on you. So the medical community, and I guess as a society, we don't put as much attention on prevention as perhaps we should, because once it's there, very hard to lose. And that's when gastric bypass, I mean, if you really are 200-300 pounds overweight, you know, it becomes medical intervention, becomes some of the things to consider.
You went to a drastic 1,000-calorie-a-day diet, as I read you.
It is, and it sounds drastic. It's not that uncommon, believe it or not. It's what is called a low-calorie diet. There's something called the very low-calorie diet that's even less than that.
Okay.
But I wasn't at a state where I had to really think about medical intervention. I could still do it naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And I used just every trick that I learned in the book. I used intermittent fasting, which is a way to extend growth hormone release from the overnight peak. And I did about 1,000 calories a day. I fasted between 3 o'clock and around 9 or 10 the next morning, and it really helped me bust fat right off of me. You know, I learned about how stubborn fat is, all the tricks that it uses, but then I also learned what is more likely to work. And so I did use diet and exercise, but I used it much more strategically. I knew how to alter and tweak a diet. I wasn't at the whims of fad diets anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I learned, you know, what works, what doesn't, and I learned how to individualize a diet. And that's really important because, you know, as we've talked about here, not everybody gains weight in the same way. Some people can eat more than others. Some people get away with things. And I learned I have very stubborn fat, probably due to my genetics, certainly my gender. You know, I'm middle-aged now. I'm not like I was when I was 20.
Yep.
I've got to take drastic measures. And you can do this on your own. You have to be very determined, and you just have to tweak your diet in ways that works for you biologically.
Patrick in Atlanta, Georgia. Patrick, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring up to your speaker the recent surge and discussion of carbohydrate restriction and what's called today the keto-adapted state. And I was wondering if she has had any personal experience or if she's used that with any of her patients or clients, and what kind of results that both she and her clients may have had.
What was that phrase you used, keto-adaptive?
Keto-adaptation, where after a 3-week period of restricting carbohydrate, your body converts the mitochondria to burn fatty acids as a fuel source as opposed to glucose. And it alleviates insulin resistance, and also it increases growth hormone and lowers insulin, but increases the sensitivity. So you get a lot of health benefits, mainly body fat used as a fuel source, so that you can lose body fat as using it as a fuel source. And you also really balances out your physiology. I've been doing it for about 9 months now, and have had fantastic health results from it. But it's very, like, if you look it up on YouTube, it seems like it's the secret of life, but only 5,000 people might have seen the video over 2 years. So,
really, no Christmas cookies like for you, or not much, Patrick. Let me take it to Sylvia and Gina. Sylvia, severe carb restriction and change the body chemistry around fat.
I think it works. I've known lots of people who've used it, and it's effective. I've used it in the past, and I found it to be effective as well. I find the downside of it is it's extremely restrictive on what you can eat. And so a diet has to work for you, not just biologically. It's tuned to your body and what it takes for you to lose weight. Mm-hmm. It has to work for you psychologically and socially as well. And so socially, I found that hard. I travel, I work. Staying with diets that have a lot of meal prep, a lot of restrictions, wasn't viable for the long term for me. And so I opted for something else in the end. But training your body to burn fat as fuel, that has worked. I mean, it's written about quite extensively in the research. And it's not the only diet, though. You can pick a number of different diets, and I think Gina actually writes about this. There's not one diet that fits all, and it's a big mistake to think that's so. You have to make it work for your life. You have to make it work for your individual biological profile, and a lot of different things can work. But remember, you're in this for the long haul. Weight maintenance is just as hard as taking weight off to begin with, because we do need fewer calories, because our bodies adapt to having lost weight. And so make sure you pick something that you can stay on for years, not just 6 months. It's got to be a way of life. And if something's too restrictive, you're likely to come off it in the end. And the problem with the keto type of diets is that one step off, one cookie, you can actually gain quite a bit of weight. So there's very little room for abandoning that diet.
Gina Collada, do you think we're finally getting a better handle on what it takes to navigate toward good weights in this country? Is our understanding better? Is our diets, broadly speaking, any better?
Well, I think that people's diets are better, at least according to the nutrition surveys that have come out. People are eating more fruits and vegetables. They're trying to stay away from processed foods. There's been a big movement to eating healthier foods, and that also includes putting healthier foods in school lunches in schools. Are we getting a better handle on what it takes? I couldn't agree more with what Sylvia just said. Different people respond to different things. But most people don't know what she just said. In my experience, I hear from a lot of people who say, this worked for me, this is the answer for everybody. And it may be the answer for a lot of people, but there's, as Sylvia just said, there's so many factors that go into what, if anything, is going to work for you. Because I think about Jessica and Keith and many other people I spoke to in working on my series on obesity, and most of them had tried, honestly, you feel like every diet anybody has ever suggested, they've tried it, and they've tried it more than once. And if it doesn't work, some people, you just have to say there are some people who are not going to respond very well. And there are some people who are going to respond well to one diet but not another, often because of their lifestyle, as Sylvia was just saying. It may not fit in with it.
Gina Collada has written about fighting obesity 60,000 different ways, it seems like, and so compellingly for the New York Times. With us today, and Gina, we're very grateful for that. Thanks so much for joining us, Gina.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. Sylvia Tara in Irvine, California. Her new book is The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. Sylvia Tara, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Thanks for all your insights. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.